At least you could put a time limit on if you had to. I'd rather see it open-ended, but if you say until Walmart workers have their first contract in these states, that would create such a phenomenal effect, you wouldn't believe it. And I think that's a pretty good idea. I think I came up with that on my own. So I'm going to promote it. But anyway, it's a very good idea because it is a factor. It really is a factor now that some of the labor leaders are making so much money that they're sliding in and out of, they're going from union work, from organizing unions supposedly, or doing something that's supposedly helping the unions, to working for the corporations. It's sort of like the revolving door between government and corporations because they're up in that stratosphere in terms of the money they're making. Not all union leaders make that, obviously. I'm talking about big leaders of national unions primarily as well. But the ones that do, they make so much money that they're out of touch. And even some regional people, a lot of regional union leaders, they make so much money they're out of touch with the concerns of the workers. By the way, I'm going to stop for 1 second. This is WMFO in Medford. That's our legal identification. You're also listening to, another way to put it is you're listening to 91.5 FM, WMFO, Medford, and it's also known as Tufts Freeform Radio, Tufts Educational Radio, Tufts Commercial Free Community-Based Radio, and we're a little slice of that community base. We are Socialist Alternative Radio here on the air, talking music from a working-class democratic socialist perspective here every other Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And also, by the way, getting back to the what you'd have to do to organize Walmart strategy. Another thing that I haven't really heard ever connected to the labor movement, but maybe I have, but if I have, it's just, you know, not regularly talked about in any way, is that, and it's going to sound like a real jump, but union leaderships and unions in general, they have to get interested, obviously more interested, more behind fighting against racism. Now, they already do. To a certain extent, but they have to do more. They have to explicitly try to link with Black Lives Matter and other groups. They will be rebuffed by some of the Black Lives Matter leaders are upper middle class. They don't care about unions or really anything but their own profiles in the movement, their own careers or whatever. But there are others that I think would readily accept that offer to work with labor to help on mass organizing drives or whatever. But in turn, labor helps fund them, helps fight for their issues. You know, the union movement should be totally behind Colin Kaepernick and the statement he made, for example. But that should extend also into the mass incarceration of primarily of black youth and people of color. You know, there should be explicit union, let's call it jailhouse solidarity. Let's call it prison solidarity. In the sense of fighting for better conditions in prisons, fighting to end mass incarceration, that sort of thing. Now, why would the labor movement be interested in that? Well, that's because workers, these are primarily workers. How many rich people end up in prison? There's working class people that end up in prison. And also, let's face it, if you do a big union drive that really hits at the heart of capitalism, you're going to suffer casualties. You're going to suffer people are going to be hauled off to jail. And you want to be able to show that there's been prison, that, you know, the labor movement cares about what goes on in prisons, basically. You want to be able to have an army of lawyers ready, taking a slightly different tact, an army of lawyers ready to get people out of prison that are being threatened. In other words, you got to be ready for that repression aspect of the government coming down on you. And unions have had to deal with that in local things a lot. Picket lines, and so on. But as the labor movement gets weaker, it's harder to get agreements from management to agree not to press charges, which are almost always spurious charges against workers for strike activity and so on. So if you do a big Walmart union drive, which would have to include, by the way, massive strikes and plant occupations or workplace occupations for recognition, just to get the union recognized, just to get a first contract. None of that will come from nice negotiation through the NLRB or any of that crap. It will come from direct action, like the rise of the CIO, the big sit-down strikes, and the big car companies in 1936-37. Completely illegal, completely necessary. The wave of strikes that followed, completely illegal. Sit-down strikes, completely necessary. The 1934 Minneapolis Teamsters general strike, completely illegal, completely necessary. The San Francisco dock workers strike in 1934, absolutely necessary, absolutely illegal. The Toledo Auto Light Strike, 1934, in Toledo, Ohio. They called out the, I believe it was the National Guard, on that strike. Bloody, bloody strike. Illegal, illegal, illegal. Absolutely necessary to get the labor movement going again in the 1930s. Labor laws and just general laws under capitalism are written to stop people from taking control over their own labor, over workplaces, or to even have a significant impact on those things. And it's taken tremendous struggle. I'm reading a book now, or starting to read a book called about the Little Steel Strike, the Memorial Day Massacre in 1937. And the authors, if I can, I haven't read the whole book yet, so but it seems like what the author's getting at the beginning at least, is that this strike was hugely important because it was basically a massacre at a point where the labor movement was really growing and on the ascendance and getting very powerful and popular, and the murders at the strike done by police of peaceful strikers were then, of course, propagandized as strikers being violent, as the labor movement being violent, as blah, blah, blah. And this guy's, I think the author's contention is that the labor movement was severely weakened by that portrayal and the lies that were told and the fear of more repression, and wasn't able to pull off big strikes after that, wasn't able to really organize it. For example, the strike was lost. I think it's more complicated than that personally, that there were still huge strike movements after that. I think the contention of this author was that there weren't any, I'll talk about this book in more detail next time, there weren't any strikes, big strikes after that, of course, but there were huge strikes, including in World War II, a period where we're taught everyone just rallied around the flag. Actually, there were huge labor strikes. Roosevelt and Truman both viciously attacked the labor movement during that time and before that time, in terms of Roosevelt's case. In 1946, there was a general strike in Oakland, California, et cetera. So it's not like the labor movement, and in 1949, 48, 49, I believe there were big strikes. So I don't quite go with the thesis, but I could see how it would have an impact on the labor movement. And really what weakened the labor movement at that time was accepting Taft-Hartley and accepting as part of the negotiations around Taft-Hartley, I believe, but and for other reasons, the AFL-CIO basically agreeing for taking concessions that they thought were concessions, like having employers provide health care insurance rather than organize the South. Like, it should have been like all-out class war, AFL-CIO on the war path, fighting hard to organize the South. Instead, they kind of stepped back from this thing they had started called Operation Dixie, stepped back and let that become a haven to this day of low wage, low union density, manufacturing and services and so on. And a huge, 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 huge mistake. Don't have time to get into other factors that led to that. What was the consciousness of the labor leaders, the role of the Stalinist Communist Party in that whole thing. But agreeing to Taft-Hartley instead of fighting Taft-Hartley, supporting the Democratic Party instead of forming a labor party would be another big factor. Then agreeing to stop Operation Dixie, not doing enough to fight racism. I mean, the labor movement was much more involved in the civil rights movement than people realize, but it should have been more involved, much more involved, broadly speaking. There were certain unions and certain union activists like A. Philip Randolph that played key, crucial behind-the-scenes roles in the labor movement. The union, I mean, AFSCME played a very visible role with Martin Luther King in the civil rights movement. But there should have been more happening as well on top of that. So anyway, what I want to do is contrast that earlier look at Ginger Jensen's campaign in Minneapolis with right now someone that could be leading a mass movement, or at least helping lead a mass movement against Trump, and instead confining everything to the Democratic Party, or most of what he's bothering with to the Democratic Party. That's Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is in New Hampshire right now supporting Democrats, shilling for the Democrats in New Hampshire. There must be some local elections coming up or something. And basically what you hear from a lot of activists, so-called activists or people that can't see beyond the Democratic Party, is they're basically just waiting to 2018 and assuming that there will be this wave of elections of Democrats around the country, and that will somehow help, the situation. Well, remember, people that buy into that strategy, the presidency is not coming up for re-election and all that. All those positions, it's not going to be an election year, a presidential election year election. And those are traditionally, unfortunately, less paid attention to, much lower turnout. I mean, I think the low turnout is basically a lack of choice and the domination of money in the whole thing, but and capitalism. But, you know, there is also a certain, I would say, logic to the fact that, you know, the corporate media doesn't pay as much attention to those elections, and therefore the people just understanding there's an election today, I got to go vote, you know, that translates into basic less of a turnout on non-presidential election year elections. And 2018 will be one of them. And so people are just saying, let's not do anything against Trump. Let's just fight when it comes to 2018 to get Democrats elected. Well, a lot of cities and states, Democrats are already there, and they're doing the same austerity measures, the same neoliberal policies that really Trump is doing. There's an article by Paul Street from Counterpunch, counterpunch.org, all one word, Counterpunch. That this is a sort of liberal left website where they just publish a lot of essays. Their reason to be, I guess, is to publish a lot of left-wing essays from a variety of opinions, some of which are basically liberal opinions in my opinion, so that they cover a broad ground, and I think they're just there to try to get out some information and some analysis, which is okay, but it is all over the place. So you can read very contradictory articles in the same issue almost, or near the same issues. It goes out on paper still a little bit, but most people see it through the internet, gets a lot of hits. Article by Paul Street, who's written for Counterpunch before, the not-so-radical, quote-unquote, socialist from Vermont. I think it was a really good article. I don't have time to go into it a lot, but you might want to check it out. It came from October 20th. There is a couple things I want to look at here. One is, this Paul Street says, Democratic socialist, that's in quotes, Bernie Sanders goes out of his way to deny any allegiance to radical ideas, quote unquote. He has a much less well radical and democratic take on American workers' need for shorter hours. Look at this passage from his recently published book, Bernie Sanders' Guide to Political Revolution. Quote, millions of Americans are overworked, underpaid, and under enormous stress. Some are working two or three jobs to try to care for their families. Research shows that vacations reduce stress, strengthen family relationships, increase productivity, and prevent illness. I just lost my train of reading here. Prevent illness. But 41% of workers didn't take any vacation in 2015. Oh, I'm raising my hand for that one. Americans are with their families. Americans are working more hours than the people of any major developed country. They need time to rest and recuperate, travel the country, visit loved ones, or simply spend time at home with their families. Now, this all sounds really good. He says legislation requires employers to provide at least 10 days of paid vacation to workers in this country every year. Now, what Street says is that this is not a radical... Oh, I'm sorry, he's still quoting Sanders' book. This is not a radical idea. It's already being done in almost every country in the world, etc. Now, Street says it's good that Sanders is raising the all-too-neglected issue of working hours, but this selection from his book is quite conservative. Sanders fails to mention that workers need time to undertake informed and collective popular resistance and class struggle to resist and indeed, sorry to get so radical, overthrow the system that has turned the United States into an abject plutocracy while putting livable ecology at grave peril. Then Sanders goes out of his way to describe his modest call for 10 days, what about 40 per year, according to Street. Paid vacation, not a radical idea. And the real kicker says that paid vacations would be great because they would, quote, boost productivity and worker loyalty, end quote. So Sanders is keeping a lot of his, and I've seen this before, a lot of his rhetoric within the bounds of capitalism, but not only that, but actually sowing illusions in some of the things that capitalism is always propagandizing about. He goes into more of that. Single payer, quote Sanders saying, this again, Sanders, when we talk about our current healthcare system, what is often overlooked is the negative impact it has on our entrepreneurial spirit. Millions of Americans remain in their jobs today, not because they want to be there, not because they enjoy their work, because their current employer provides decent, because their current employer provides decent health care benefits to them and their families. And that's very true. But what's this entrepreneurial spirit stuff? Street, the author, says, take that, Eugene Debs. What does Bernie mean about our economy, quote-unquote? Didn't he quite properly note during the campaign that the U.S. economic system is rigged for the benefit of the wealthy few, increasing a top-tenth of an upper U.S. 1% that owes as much wealth as the bottom 90%? Entrepreneurial spirit? Seriously? So we should support single payer because we're supposedly free up Americans to become capitalists, not socialists? That's a kind of a stretch there, because you're obviously not a capitalist just because you, you're only a capitalist if you own the means of production, basically. If you are investing money in a big business or a small business, I suppose, but mainly big businesses to increase profits, basically. People that might identify themselves as capitalists probably aren't involved. Usually, aren't involved in that. Some people that like to identify themselves as capitalists are clearly not involved in owning. They're not sitting on any corporate boards. They might own stock, through a third party. That doesn't quite count as being a capitalist. A capitalist is someone that could manipulate that stock to make it have an effect on investment decisions. Etc. So anyways, Street's analysis there's a little off, but he goes on to, I mean, basically what he's saying is I think correct, that you don't have to tap into the mythology of capitalism in order to organize people around something that would be quite popular, like universal health care, Street gives other examples of Sanders's even just his rhetoric not being very socialist or not being socialist at all to real problems. Sanders is not calling for the nationalization of the country's leading arch parasitic and ecocidal financial institutions. He wants to, quote, reform Wall Street, unquote. So basically what he's doing is he's dipping into Sanders' Guide to a Political Revolution book and pointing out some real problems with it in terms of someone that might call themselves or be called. I find it mostly Sanders is called a socialist rather than him bringing up that word at this point in time. But, here's a real kicker, and this is one that a lot of Sanders supporters refuse to engage with, but I think it's extremely important. Street says Bernie Sanders' Guide to Political Revolution says nothing, and I really mean nothing, about the giant U.S. Pentagon system, which carries the world's single largest institutional carbon footprint while paying for at least 800 military bases spread across more than 80 foreign countries and keeping, in David Vine's words, troops or other military personnel in about 160 foreign countries and territories. That, of course, is the U.S. government and U.S. troops and so on. You will search the book's index and text in vain for the following words and phrases: Pentagon, Pentagon system, empire, imperialism, military, militarism, military-industrial complex, or even just foreign policy. Also absent, by the way, is capitalism. And here's a missing term from the guide's glossary. This is, again, from Sanders' book, of economic terms, military Keynesianism. These are all too predictable, if major, deletions, Street continues. Bernie F-35 Sanders, the especially wasteful F-35 was a job creator in his home state, remains dysfunctionally wedded to the U.S. empire, which accounts for more than 40% of Homo sapiens' blood-drenched military budget. The empire attachment is a huge mistake, both morally and practically, as the leading and unabashedly radical writer and speaker Glenn Activist noted on Black Agenda Report last June, quote, the United States does not have a national health care system worthy of its name because it is in the war business, not the health business, not the social equality business. In the U.S., progress is defined by global dominance of the U.S. state, chiefly in military terms, rather than domestic social development. War is not a side issue in the United States. It is the central political issue on which all others turn. War mania is the enemy of all social progress, especially so when it unites disparate social forces in opposition to their own interests in the service of an imperialist state that is the tool of a rapacious white capitalist elite. That's from Black Agenda Report, Glenn Ford. Paul Street, author of this article, riffs on that, gets into, I don't know how, but somehow dips into DSA's founded, Democratic Socialist of America Foundation there. I don't have time to like really check, see how he made that connection. But anyway, so this is a really good article. And I'll just leave it there. I don't want to read too much of the article, but it's again, the Not-So-Radical Socialists from Vermont, Paul Street, October 20th, 2017, from counterpunch.org. And we're going to take a pivot, as they like to say now in the trendy use of that word, towards international events, and then work our way back maybe to the U.S. a little bit. And some international events you probably haven't heard much of, so stay tuned. We're going to also take a musical break here, and we'll be back after some music.
Spanish songs in Andalusia, the tune inside in the days of 39. The Vendana open, Federico lockers, dead and gone. Bullet holes in the cemetery wall. The black car of the Johnny of the beer. Spanish bombs on the Costa Rica are flying in on the DC-10 tonight. Spanish bombs, you got the care of it, Benito. You got the cuera, oh my god, a thong. Spanish bombs, you got the care of it, Benito. Disco casino, the freedom fighters died up on the hill. They sang the red flag, they wore the black one. After they died it was Mockingbird Hill. Back from the buses, went up in flashes. The Irish too, drenched in blood. Spanish bombs, shattered the hotels. A senorita's nose was nipped in the bud. Spanish bombs, you're the queer of infinito. You're the queer of, oh my god.
By The Clash from their album London Calling. That was not a random selection. That was related to what we're about to talk about, which is the struggle for Catalonian independence and the repressive Francoist, you know, fascist-like response. Not full-blown fascism, but it's using tactics from the days when Spain was ruled by a fascist dictator. And basically, Catalan is a part of Spain where Barcelona is, sort of, would that be northeast Spain? I was confused what's west and what's east at that in Europe. Northeast Spain around Barcelona. And at the time of the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, Catalonia played a huge role in that struggle, the people of Catalonia, and there was a movement for Catalonian independence then. And it's and when Franco and the fascists, put down the revolution in Spain in the 30s, one of the first things they did was to attack independence movements, especially Catalan, and forbid the use of the Catalan language and so on. Since Franco lost power, there's been a resurgence of the Catalan language and the push for independence, and there have been times where referendums were carried out, and it wasn't until recently, until just, you know, the last few weeks, last month or so, that the when another referendum was due to be voted on, that the Spanish government decided to go back to the methods of the Franco regime and just repress the voting, not allow the voting, to actually send troops and police into voting places and abuse the people there and so on. So there's an ongoing struggle there. Now, Socialist Alternative is in political solidarity with the Committee for Workers International, which recently, which has had supporters in Spain. Recently, there was a large group of socialists, relatively large group of socialists, that rejoined the Committee for Workers International, Izquierda Revolucionario, and including a grouping in Catalan as part of that party, part of that organization. So this is a statement I'm going to read a little bit from by Izquierda Revolucionario, the CWI in the Spanish state. There are members in Catalan as well. Continue the fight until we can win a Catalan socialist republic. Catalan experienced a historic day on October 3rd. Millions of workers, young people, and citizens paralyzed. Now, this article is from October 4th, by the way. You can find more recent articles. Go to socialistworld.net. I thought this article brought up some stuff that hasn't been covered in the corporate media here, so I'm reading it even though it's a couple weeks old. Millions of workers, young people, and citizens paralyzed companies, transport, education, administration. They took to the streets crying out against the brutal police repression of October 1st. That was of the attempt to vote for independence. And threats of more violence against the Catalan people by the Spanish Prime Minister, Rajoy, and Partido Popular, People's Party, PP, government ministers. The possibility of achieving a Catalan Republic through revolutionary mobilization of the masses of people is causing panic among the Spanish ruling class. They know this victory would open the way to the struggle for the socialist transformation of society in Catalonia and the rest of the Spanish state. Now, I'm going to pause there and just say why that might be. Well, Catalan has a certain bit of autonomy, right? And the left in Catalan and throughout Spain, they've been fighting the austerity measures of both the Social Democratic Party there, the PSOE, which long ago became pro-capitalist, and conservative and liberal parties. So, and the Spanish left is pretty big compared to other parts of the world. And for example, they have a new movement. They had a relatively new movement there called Podemos that that very quickly got some parliamentary representation. So my point is that, like, the autonomous government in Catalan that exists, which in mainly word only, but it does exist. It will go through the motions. It will pass progressive legislation, so even socialist like demands around housing and so on. And then they'll go to the Spanish Parliament and they'll just say, no, that's illegal. You can't do that. You know? So this is what, if Catalan was able to break through to independence, even though there are, of course, just, you know, there are conservatives and liberals involved in the Catalan nationalist movement in building a Catalan state, the objective effect it would have of being able to separate off from Spain and the destabilization that would happen, plus the rising hopes of the people, because a lot of people support, nationalist movements, like of small, weak country, relatively weak countries or groups of people, because they see that their repression comes from this nation state that's forcing them to stay a part of it, you know, like Quebec and Canada being forced to stay part of Canada, or here Catalonia being forced to stay part of Spain. Many people see any improvements that can be, real improvements that can be gained, real changes are going to only be done through independence. Now, as socialists, as Marxists, that's not really the only way to achieve that. That is one possibility. But more importantly, we see a way to keep the unity of the working class, the unions, the political parties, and so on, despite the you know, organizing for an independent, small, you know, state. And in order to reach people that sort of see everything through the prism of independence or not independence, in terms of what's open to them, socialists should be supporting the independence movement in Catalan. Not in just a blanket way, saying, but we need also socialist Catalan, socialist Catalonia. Now, there's this constitution that was brought about in Spain in 1978, and you had the king of Spain, Philip VI, address the nation, the whole country, on the night of October 3rd, citing this constitution. But this is after this violence that was done by the police against the vote, against this, you know, in Catalonia. The police from Spain sent over to stop the vote, and they were... you know, they've arrested a lot of people. They've arrested two people that that were leaders of the movement indefinitely. No bail being set. And this article goes on to say this oppression of the current government, the PP government, and the state apparatus against the people of Catalonia shows their true DNA and the legacy of Franco that continues within them. After October 1st, far from retreating, the reaction has intensified. Its nationalist Spanish propaganda reaction, meaning far right. They present the mobilization of 16,000 police and civilian police and future repressive measures as legitimate actions to defend the law of the state. This is the voice of the state as well. But by what state and by what right? What right does a government full of corruption and thieves who have plundered the public resources to rich minority have to claim the authority to act in this way? It is the state of the bankers who have their hands full of billions of stolen euros. The rule of law, quote-unquote, drowns us in mass unemployment, precarious jobs, low wages, and poverty and misery. The rule of law, born of the Pact of 1978, when the Spanish bourgeoisie and the leaders of the organizations of the left, the PCE, the Communist Party, PSOE, the Social Democratic Party, agreed to reform the dictatorship to abort a revolutionary situation, guaranteed the bourgeoisie control through a monarchical and parliamentary regime that included many authoritarian elements. In fact, the 1978 Constitution sanctioned many things. A king imposed by Franco. Laws that guaranteed the impunity for the crimes of the dictatorship and the state apparatus and the judiciary. Police and military forces remained in the hands of the usual reactionaries, etc. So they're giving a good history. And this, you know, national oppression and class oppression are intertwined in the history of Spain. 1909, 1931, 1934, 1936, 1977, this independence for Catalonia has come up, and now, generating revolutionary potential has defied the forms of political domination of the Spanish capitalist regime. The working class and youth of the whole state must understand that the cause of the people of Catalonia is also ours. Quote, a people who oppress another can never be free, said Karl Marx. This is why the labor movement, and I'm quoting the article again, this is why the labor movement, throughout its history, always inscribed in its flag that the struggle for national liberation, for the self-determination of the oppressed nations, as part of the struggle for the socialist transformation of society. This is the labor movement internationally, in its broadest sense. So it goes on to new things being prepared back at, you know, a couple weeks ago, which have, some of them have already been done, and including arresting two of the leaders. And you should try to, I would say, if you don't know Spanish, check out The Guardian in the UK. They've been following the story much closer than the corporate media. Of course, check out socialistworld.net, which is where this article came from on October 4th. October 3rd, 4th, socialistworld.net. So the situation in Catalonia is some people take a very superficial view of it. And say, well, why do I care about national independence for You know, I'm say some leftists are like, I'm, you know, anti-state or whatever, you know. Well, yeah, so are socialists. But we're talking about the process in which to get there. That there's a real contribution to Marxist theory from Lenin, Vladimir Lenin and others, who had to deal with the question concretely, like Russia at the time of its revolution was a prison house of nations, quote-unquote. It was, you know, the Tsarist regimes had conquered countries, neighboring countries that were not part of, you know, Russian-speaking or part of this, like, Russian empire, didn't want to be part of it, and they were forced to be. So when the Bolsheviks, for example, the party that Lenin was in, went and organized people in outlying areas, they had to work, on the one hand, for keeping workers' unity across ethnic, racial, gender lines, etc., but at the same time, fight against oppression of minorities, including minorities fighting for a state, their own state. Because as I said earlier, that seems to be the way out. Some people identify that as the way out for themselves. And the, you know, if they can't see the whole system as the problem, they'll see, well, if we just had our own capitalists in power or we had independence, things would be better. Now, this isn't true. But on the other hand, what loyalty, what fealty do we have as socialists, as international socialists, to the borders, the completely arbitrary borders constructed by capitalist countries and bourgeois powers to just cement their own rule? I mean, there's no reason to bow down to the way the map looks right now, because it's changed a hell of a lot. Most of the time in the 20th century, 21st centuries, through the machinations of colonialism and imperialism by capitalism, by big business. And so that's many nation states have been cobbled together from peoples speaking different languages, having different customs and so on. Now, capitalism does force them together in an economic system, and we have to take it, we have to understand that. And there are ways to organize for common struggle and common change towards socialism, and that should stay the same. So, for example, Catalan workers should be in the same organization, or at least in close solidarity with workers in the rest of Spain, in the terms of the unions, in terms of workers' parties, and so on. At the same time, their struggle for independence should be fought for and respected and organized for. But not just stopping with formal independence on a capitalist basis, but struggling for a Catalan republic, socialist republic. And just achieving that would open up the situation in Spain more for working people and so on. Now, there's also, as we mentioned on the show, where 2017 is the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, and where this is being, talked about a little bit in the corporate media, and there's been some, you know, television programs here and in other countries commemorating it, mostly bad, of course, because who owns the airwaves, right? It's this capitalist state. But it's making a bit of an impact around, and you might see more discussion of the Russian Revolution. It's very, very important you try to find out, go to socialistworld.net, go to socialistalternative.org, try to find other sources. Read John Reed's book, R-E-E-D-S, Reed, R-E-E-D, his book, 10 Days That Shook the World. He was an American socialist that witnessed the Russian Revolution and wrote about it as a journalist. Read Leon Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution. Don't, and that's a very long book, so that's a big ask, but, you know, what I'm getting at is that there are some truthful renditions of what happened during the Russian Revolution. But there is a ton of sloggy, smelly CIA-inspired or just, inspired by people that have internalized the repression of capitalism to trash the Russian Revolution, including a lot of college professors that claim to be left-wing, including a lot of liberals, etc. They don't see the need to go all the way and support, you know, fundamental transformation of society, democratic socialism, and they're filled with incredible, propaganda, mistruths, misinformation about the Russian Revolution. In fact, I talked about a book last show, China Mieville's October. This is a new book just out this year, where he talks about 1917 in Russia. Calls it October because October was the final revolution. There were two revolutions, February and October, and that was the one that put the socialists in power, the October Revolution. The book, I started to read it, seems okay, but I'm reading from a review of a member of the Committee for Works International in Sweden, who published an article about it. I drew recently 10/20, I think the article came out, at September 20th, I'm sorry, October 20th. And he talks about how, well, yeah, it's a pretty good book, but there's some things Mieville gets wrong. Now, you might have heard of Mieville from his science fiction work, which I've read a little bit of and I like. And I'm not saying don't read this book or other books of his, but I just want to get out some information here that I thought was really good that this Per Akke Westerlund, that's the name of the author, pointed out in his book review here. He said, a new book gives good facts in defense of the revolution, but also adopts a wavering position towards common slanders against Lenin and the Bolsheviks. He calls it a kind of light version of Trotsky's classic history of the Russian Revolution. I think Mieville probably had more in mind the 10 Days to Destroy the World by John Reed, but whatever. It's worth reading, basically, is what Per is saying. And here's some good points about the book. Mieville underlies the racism and anti-Semitism of the Tsarist regimes, as well as the white counter-revolutionary forces from 1918 onwards. In the revolution in 1905, the Tsar launched the proto-fascist groups, the Black Hundreds. In contrast, quote, the socialist movement in the empire is always multi-ethnic, disproportionately compromising those of minority groups and nations. And that's one reason I thought of reading this, because we were just talking about the struggle in Catalonia. He also describes, for example, the first all-Russian Muslim conference in April 1917. The conference agreed on 10 principles, including women's right to vote, equality of the sexes, and the non-compulsory nature of the hijab. Describing Lenin's struggles to turn the Bolsheviks away from the conciliationism after February, Mieville's emphasizes Alexander Kollontai's role in bringing Lenin's letters from afar to Russia in March. She also, this is Kollontai, attacked any hesitation on the demands for women's right to vote, and she played a leading role in the 40,000 member women's demonstration that same month. But here's where it gets into the negative, that Mieville doesn't really get into what happened with the way forward in March and April within Russia. For example, Lenin's position was stressing the need for the working class to take power, contrary to conciliatory views towards the provisional government by other Bolshevik leaders. I won't read that quote. So after October is where Per really goes after this. The book says that basically, Mieville doesn't put the Constituent Assembly in a context, doesn't put Stalinism in a good context, or how did that arise? The fact that Russia was just beginning to construct socialism, it had to be a series of revolutions, including in other countries. That, quote, the Bolsheviks under Lenin and Trotsky never lost focus on the international socialist revolution. Victories in other countries, above all industrialized Germany, would have changed everything. Mieville's readers will understand the Russian Revolution became isolated, but necessary experiences and roots, but not why it became isolated. The key lessons from 1917 revolution and subsequent revolutions is the absolute need for a revolutionary party with necessary experiences and roots, programs, and actions. The Bolshevik Party's history of party building through struggles and debates was lacking in other countries like Germany, Austria, Hungary, Finland, and other during the revolutionary movements in the years after 1917. Then he gets into the Constituent Assembly, which I just mentioned. Instead, Mieville tries to find the roots of Stalinism and the decision of the Bolsheviks around the Constituent Assembly. But actually, dissolving the Constituent Assembly was not blocking some kind of quote-unquote democracy. It was to prevent a new dual power in a situation where the working class had already taken power through the Soviets, which were mass councils of workers, peasants, and soldiers exercising direct democracy. The Constituent Assembly was a kind of opinion poll in which the Bolsheviks got 9 million votes and won the majority in Petrograd and Moscow, compared with, for example, the Mensheviks, 668,000 votes, the Bourgeois Cadet Party, 1.8 million, the Social Revolutionaries became the biggest party with 16.5 million, but their candidates were right-wing SR figures selected long after the left Socialist Revolutionaries had become the majority of that party. The dissolution of the assembly was a calm event that caused almost no reaction or protests. And not, this is not a direct quote, but just, and the reason it was calm was because the Soviets were growing so rapidly and were seen as the way that things were being run, basically, in the new country, these mass workers and peasants councils. That's what Soviet means, council. Also, apparently, Mieville brings up Kronstadt. I haven't read that far in the book yet, but Per says, the case of the suppression of Kronstadt in 1920 was not a major issue at the time. It was raised by anarchists in the 30s, long after it happened, in order to counter Trotsky's criticism of the anarchist leader's role in the Spanish Revolution. Under extremely difficult conditions facing the young worker state at the height of the Civil War against the White Armies, it's talking about Russia in 1918-19, and foreign invasion, in reality, Kronstadt in 1921 could have served as a launching pad for the counter-revolution. Mayville does not understand that the victory of the political counter-revolution of Stalin and the rising state bureaucracy was not possible through a long, drawn-out civil war. Through a long, drawn-out civil war, which is what happened. His description of the crucial debates is superficial and almost neutral. Between 1924 and 1928, atmosphere in Russia grows more and more toxic, infighting in the party more bitter, and the shifting of allegiances and cliques more urgent and dangerous. Now, the importance of those debates, again, quoting from the article, was not primarily about the atmosphere, but their content. Nationalism or internationalism? Bolshevism or Menshevism? Bureaucracy or workers' democracy? It was real Bolshevism as represented by Lenin in his last years, and Trotsky and the left opposition organization that conducted a courageous struggle against the degeneration of the Soviet Russia into a Stalinist dictatorship. So maybe Mieville will write a second volume for after 1917 and get that stuff right. I doubt it. But as we approach the 100th anniversary of the October Revolution in Russia, there is a world historic event largely being ignored by the Putin regime and mass media, and the Russian Revolution. And there's also an election coming out in the fall. Election coming out in March 2018 in Russia. So there's an article worth reading, I think, called Russia Preparing for the Fallout from the Presidential Election. And it's from 18 October 2017. Rob Jones from Socialist Alternative, same name in Russia, part of the CWI, Committee for Works International. And what you hear, the reason I'm talking about this article very, very briefly, because we're running out of time, is because it gets into what's going on in Russia among working people and society in general in Russia, rather than what we hear in this country is just about Putin and about alleged support for the Democrats. I'm sorry, alleged support for messing up the election, which is extremely ironic since the United States has its hand messing up elections for hundreds of years, actually, or at least 100 years, we'll say. Well, more than that, actually, in other countries. I don't have time to get into this article. It's quite long, but it's really worth reading about what's happening in Russia right now and what the effects of the upcoming election might be, including, things that you just won't hear in the corporate media here. And that's, again, from socialistworld.net, October 18th, Russia Preparing for the Fallout from the President Election by Rob Jones. And I'm talking really fast here because I have to. Also in international news in Hong Kong, there was a crackdown on election results there. Hong Kong is probably regarded as democratic, even though it is back under the rule of China and no longer Britain. It has had democratic elections since that has happened, but that is changing now, and there is a crackdown. So, for example, a legislator nickname of Long Hair of the League of Social Democrats was purged from undemocratically from the government. That would be Leung Kwag Hung, for example, and others. So the Committee for Works International in Hong Kong is leading a international campaign to stop repression in Hong Kong, and started a petition among members of parliament, left political parties, union activists in more than 15 countries, and demanding release of political prisoners in Hong Kong. And the Communist Party leadership in China, no longer communist, Stalinist, not even Stalinist, really state capitalist, they object to this campaign and to the saying that there are political prisoners, but there are, including many youngsters and prominent representatives of the 2014 Umbrella Movement, have had harsh jail sentences put on them. So there's a crackdown on democratic protest and non-approved candidates getting elected to the legislature there. So if you want more information about that, also go to chinaworker.info or chinaworker.org. I'm not sure about chinaworker.org. Hold on. I think it's chinaworker.info. Also go to socialistworld.net. You'll see articles about that. Last but not least, a really good book review by, again, very long article, good, I mean, in a good sense, a very in-depth article by George Martin Fell Brown from the latest issue of, I'm not sure it was in the paper or it's on the website, but just go to socialistalternative.org or Socialist Alternatives newspaper to find it. It's called Book Review, Trotsky's on Trial. A author named Donna T. Haverty Stack, Free Speech and Political Persecution Since the Age of FDR. She's written a book from sort of a civil liberties viewpoint of what happened to the Socialist Workers Party in 1941 when the Smith Act was used against them on June 27, 1941, when the FBI carried out a raid on the office of the Socialist Workers Party in Minneapolis and St. Paul. 29 SWP members were then put on trial under the Smith Act for conspiracy to overthrow the U.S. government. No such conspiracy existed. The Smith Act was used to assert that the SWP's Trotsky's beliefs could constitute a threat to national security. Now, they were later, this was later thrown out, by the way. 1986, courts eventually overturned the sedition ruling and vindicated the SWP. Of course, by then, the SWP was much, you know, smaller, different organization, but than it was in 1941. But anyway, so the book review by George Martin Fell Brown, is quite good. And the reason it's worth reading is not just for a book you might not bother to read, Trotsky's on Trial, Free Speech and Political Persecution Since the Age of FDR, which is really worth reading, a valuable resource for socialists and Trotskyists eager to learn about their history, according to George. But it's also points out this book review, you know, riffing from the book, points out some really good facts about the beginnings of McCarthyism that actually exist in the Roosevelt administration. How many of you out there know that? How many liberals out there who idealize Roosevelt, who should not be idealized? And none of the icons of the Democratic Party stand up to scrutiny, by the way, including Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, or any of the rest of them. Let me just read a little bit here. Roosevelt and the Little Red Scare. Haverty Stack, that's the author, places the Minneapolis sedition trial in the context of an event known as, quote, the Little Red Scare, after Stalin, engaging in one of his many bureaucratic zigzags, signed a non-aggression pact with Hitler in 1939, a wave of anti-communist and xenophobic paranoia spread throughout the country. The panic ended once Stalin reversed course and looked to form an alliance with the U.S. and British imperialism in World War II, to which the Stalinists supported everything else, including the class struggle. The Little Red Scare isn't as well known as the bigger Red Scares in the McCarthy era, or in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution, the Palmer Raids, and so on. But during this period of the 1939-40, the Roosevelt administration made use of the anti-communist and xenophobic hysteria, as an excuse to crack down on the socialist working class movement that had developed since the early 1930s. Many activists look fondly back on the Roosevelt administration and see the New Deal era of the Democratic Party as a model to follow. But Haverty Stack reveals that the Democratic Party under Roosevelt was the main driving force behind the crackdowns on civil liberties that would later flourish under McCarthyism. The Smith Act was named after Democratic Congressman Howard Smith. Meanwhile, another Democratic congressman, Martin Dies Jr., would lead the House Un-American Activities Committee, later made notorious by Senator Joseph McCarthy. Ostensibly, the Smith Act was intended to help protect the United States against the threat of fascism. Fascist forces were a real threat at the time, with pro-Hitler Silver Shirt gangs violently attacking labor struggles and a significant layer of the U.S. ruling class was sympathetic to Hitler. But during the Little Red Scare, the Smith Act quickly morphed into an attack on quote-unquote extremism in general and left-wing activism in particular. Under the bill, mere advocacy of revolutionary change was criminalized. Legislation of this sort had already existed during times of war, but this was the first time since John Adams that speech of this sort was criminalized during peacetime. The bill was also xenophobic to the core, playing on the fears of radical immigrants meddling in America's affairs on behalf of the Kremlin. Originally called the Alien Registration Act, it allowed for the deportation of immigrants who held revolutionary views. An earlier version of the bill also even included the provisions for detention camps of suspicious immigrants. At that point, any pretense that this was about fighting fascism could be safely thrown out the window. But the bill's first target would not be fascists or members of the Communist Party, but the Trotskyists, who fought against Stalin's political counter-revolution, which overturned the institutions of workers' democracy in the Soviet Union and brought a privileged bureaucracy to power. So I'll leave it at that. But it's really worth reading more of this book review to find out more about Roosevelt and all that, but also to the real Roosevelt, but also to see what happened to the SWP and what the book gets right and what it kind of fails on. So you've been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working-class, democratic, socialist perspective. Get in touch with us by going to Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. For more information about Socialist Alternative, go to info@socialistalternative.org or Facebook Socialist Alternative USA. Here in the Boston area, you can call 910-639-3948. Many ways to get in touch. Go to socialistalternative.org, the website. And again, don't just, you know, read about what's going on. Don't just rail at the injustices and the unfairness and the inequality and the lack of a future for a lot of us. But instead, do something about it, and that is join the movement, fight for socialism. And we're going to leave it on that high note. And we're going to get into some music by, as we leave, Tom Morello and the Night Watchman. And we'll be back in 2 weeks for another version of Socialist Alternative Radio. If it's November by then, which I think it is, we're going to be concentrating on that 100-year anniversary of the Russian Revolution, which was the most democratic revolution in history, believe it or not. And we'll prove that next time. Thanks for listening. And this was Socialist Alternative Radio.
Presidents or popes, or kings or queens or generals, or CIA kingpins running dope. History's not made by nine robed men, or billionaires or bankers. It's not made by them. Black Spartacus heart attack machine. Heart attack machine. Black Spartacus heart attack machine. Might throw a little money around, wondering who can be bought. Some might find they're weaker, some stronger than they thought.